one of the three great luminaries of the Baha'i faith in the British Isles, is George Townsend of Ireland. He occupies a unique position in Baha'i history as he was the first ordained priest in Christendom to renounce his vows in order to become a Baha'i, the first hand of the cause in Europe, called by the Guardian the preeminent Baha'i writer and Baha'u'llah's chosen instrument. He assisted the Guardian for many years with English translation of Baha'i scripture. The following account is condensed from the excellent and fascinating biography written by David Hoffman, retired member of the Universal House of Justice, who knew him personally. George Townsend was born on June 14, 1876, in Dublin, to an eminent, wealthy, and philanthropic family, one of 14 children. He graduated from Hertford College at Oxford, having studied classic literature and English. A tall fellow, he excelled in running sports. A literary and administrative talent began to emerge. Back in Dublin, he wrote for the Irish Times and worked in a law firm, earning a law degree, but he became unhappy in this occupation. His generous father offered to support him for 2 years in any country he would choose. Can you believe he chose Salt Lake City, Utah? What a drastic change from the Emerald Isle! For 2 years he camped and explored, going on horseback into the Rocky Mountains and to Yellowstone Park, sometimes working as a logger. During this time, he came across a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, the holy book of the Hindu religion. It initiated within him a spiritual longing to know and to serve God. He became active in the church of his family, the Anglican Church, known in America as the Episcopal Church. He was ordained as a priest in 1906 in St. Mark's Cathedral, Salt Lake City, and was in charge of a mission to the Mormons and Indians at Provo and Springville, Utah. However, in 1909 he became interested in a mystical, ethical movement called the Great Work. He left the ministry and worked 1 year teaching in Salt Lake City High School. The next year he met a man from the University of the South, an Episcopalian-owned college in Sewanee, Tennessee, who offered Reverend Townsend a position there, and it was accepted. His life was happily filled with academic accomplishments, both as a special theology student and assistant professor of English. More importantly, he found a love, Nellie Roche, a schoolteacher in Nashville. They planned to get married in summer of 1913 at George's family home in Ireland, and then return to Sewanee in autumn. George was now an American citizen. He left first to make arrangements, and Nellie was to follow. The prospect of security in academia and a beautiful, talented bride must have brought him to a pinnacle of joyful anticipation. But bewildering disappointments and defeats were about to break. In Ireland, awaiting the arrival of Nellie, he received a heartbreaking telegram from her. Nellie broke their engagement in order to help a sister who had no one else to turn to but Nellie. George returned to Sewanee and taught there for 3 more years. Nellie became a successful life insurance underwriter in Nashville. She never married. But don't forget her. Their paths will cross many years later in a beautiful way. Another crushing disappointment was 3 years later when the movement, the Great Work, which he had supported for 6 years, was found to be financially fraudulent and fell apart. That summer he traveled to Ireland and planned to return to Sewanee for the autumn term. A third blow of suffering, this time physical, was George's lot. He had been prone to eye trouble in the past, and it came again, causing blindness for several weeks. He cabled his resignation to the university. As Mr. Hoffman wrote, "In one great wave of calamity, he had lost his bride, his sight, his spiritual allegiance, and his employment." His sight was eventually restored, but at the age of 41, he had to decide what to do for a livelihood. His mother encouraged him to return to the work of the priesthood in the Church of Ireland. While he was recovering from blindness in the winter of 1916, he received a little gift from a friend at Sewanee, a few pamphlets about the Baha'i faith. Ever the truth-seeker, it interested him, and he wrote for the books offered, and received 3 volumes of Tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá. In 1918, he married Anna Sarah Maxwell, called Nancy, and soon accepted the position of rector at a small village church in Western Ireland. Son Brian was born in 1920, and daughter Una in 1921. Later, he would be elected a canon of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin and Archdeacon of Clonfert. He was suggested for a bishopric, but declined the honor. Soon after settling into the spacious parsonage at Ahaspraw, County Galway, George wrote to Abdu'l-Bahá, expressing his attraction to the Baha'i teachings and prayers. An extensive and loving reply came from Abdu'l-Bahá. Before long, George wrote again to Abdu'l-Bahá, declaring his belief through a beautiful poem, the first lines, "Hail to thee, Scion of glory, whose utterance poureth abroad the joy of the heavenly knowledge and the light of the greatest of days." The loving, encouraging reply from Abdu'l-Bahá promised him the confirmations of the kingdom of God and expressed Abdu'l-Bahá's hope that, quote, "thy church will come under the heavenly Jerusalem," end quote. This phrase became George's charter of action, and for the rest of his life he struggled to fulfill this hope of Abdu'l-Bahá's. November 16, 1921, George wrote a long letter to Abdu'l-Bahá of remarkable humility and longing for self-sacrifice. It was received in Haifa on December 8, 10 days after the ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá. We can feel assured, however, that Abdu'l-Bahá was always totally aware of George's pure heart and great destiny from the very beginning. George immediately turned his pure-hearted devotion to Shoghi Effendi, the grandson of Abdu'l-Bahá, appointed in his will and testament to be the guardian of the cause of God. In 1926, George wrote to the guardian offering to help him with refining English translations of some of the writings of Baha'u'llah. The overworked guardian immediately and warmly welcomed this collaboration, which continued for the next 18 years. The first project was The Hidden Words. For this and many more after that, the guardian wrote warm praise. Quote, "Your excellent judgment, your literary ability, and your keen sympathy and devoted care in revising passages which I have rendered into English are deeply appreciated by me, and I shall make use of your suggestions. I hope to send you some more in future," end quote. In addition, The Guardian asked George to review and edit the manuscripts of God Passes By and The Unfoldment of World Civilization, and to write the introductions to The Dawnbreakers and God Passes By, plus essays for the Baha'i World volumes. His essay on the hidden words became the introduction to it in some editions. George's literary and spiritual gifts also produced 3 persuasive books on the Baha'i faith for Christian readers, which will be briefly described later. This close collaboration developed into a deep and loving friendship. Over the years, The Guardian invited George 5 times to come to Haifa as his guest, but poor George was never able to accept. In the years prior to his resignation from the church, his responsibilities as a rector did not allow enough time off, and after his resignation, his restricted financial situation and failing health prevented him. His assistance to the Guardian afforded George a very thorough Baha'i education. The flame of his love for Baha'u'llah grew more and more consuming, and he began to long for the day when he could find a way to be independent from his ties to the church and devote all his time and strength to the cause. Prior to 1926, George believed that by staying as a clergyman and working within the church, he could gradually influence its leaders to bring the whole church into the cause of Baha'u'llah. He planned to do this mainly through his writing. His first effort was a book of prayers and meditations emphasizing renewed revelation of truth from God and a new spiritual civilization, but without directly mentioning the revelation of Baha'u'llah. Called The Altar on the Hearth, it was popular and sold well. For over 20 years, George tried to free himself from the church, but 2 serious obstacles continuously frustrated every effort. The first was the opposition of his wife, who, while having an appreciation for the Baha'i faith and George's attachment to it, would not agree to his leaving the priesthood because of the financial difficulties that would result. The thought of poverty and insecurity for herself and the 2 young children was just more than she could bear. Secondly, any other type of employment he pursued either fell through or offered no real job security. His anomalous position of being a declared yet unofficial believer puzzled many. The Guardian, always compassionate, wrote to a national spiritual assembly in 1946, quote, "Our dear Baha'i brother, George Townsend, can best serve the faith at the present time where he is. He is now contacting many high ecclesiastics in his church. Perhaps in the future, the way will open for him to travel and teach." End quote. George's duties as the rector of a country church fortunately afforded him enough free time for 3 important things: his work for the Guardian, authoring his own books, and time to spend with his children. Excursions to parks and forests, whimsical stories, producing a children's play replete with leprechauns and fairies, and tender spiritual training were the delight of Brian and Una, whose fond memories of him as a wonderful father are recorded in his biography. His next book, after The Altar on the Hearth, was The Promise of All Ages, published in 1934, which forthrightly declared progressive revelation, the mission of Baha'u'llah, and the signs Christ gave, alluding to this, the Day of God. Fortunately, it is still in print and translated into many languages. The guardian was highly pleased with George's literary abilities and said, quote, "He is the best writer we have. He is the preeminent Baha'i writer," end quote. George hoped that the promise of all ages would open the way for his church to become informed and accept Baha'u'llah as Christ returned. We should appreciate the very great bravery and detachment in George's character to do this bold proclamation. In 1934, the orthodoxy of the church was not to be questioned. Anyone doing so would be thought to be deranged or heretical. George wrote to the Guardian, quote, "The author will very soon lose both his reputation and his livelihood. The publicity and the controversy which will ensue are highly distasteful to me. I rely on Baha to give me courage and serenity in dealing with the difficulties that will arise." End quote. He fully expected to be expelled from the church for proclaiming the Baha'i faith, but this did not happen, not even a reprimand. George's longing to be free from the church prompted him to write to the National Spiritual Assembly of the British Isles, offering to sell to them the copyrights to his books. He believed that the proceeds would be sufficient to support his family. The Assembly's response was positive and resulted in the founding of the British Baha'i Publishing Trust. All business details were worked out, with the exception of one, overlooked in all the excitement, and that was the required cooperation of George's wife, Nancy. When she became aware that George planned to suddenly leave the church and rely on the uncertain sale of his writings for a livelihood, she was appalled and threatened to leave him. Realizing that the breakup of his home and marriage would be disastrous for the reputation of the cause and for himself, he gave up such a plan. Freedom was still 10 long years away. George's next book was The Heart of the Gospel, written in 1938, a brilliant appeal to Christians to hearken to the call of Baha'u'llah. It elucidates history as spiritual evolution, man's ultimate destiny, and examines gospel teachings overlooked by church theology. When it was published in 1939, he sent a copy of it to his bishop, expecting a negative response, but the bishop gave it a commendation and wrote George that he should have told much more about Baha'u'llah, for his teachings were wonderful. George then openly declared to the bishop his stand. Quote, "I have found today no original spiritual leadership except in the writings of Baha'u'llah. I have accepted his teachings in their entirety, have identified myself with his cause, and joined the Baha'i Fellowship." End quote. The bishop ignored this slap at the establishment and wrote that he would like to read George's other Baha'i book, The Promise of All Ages. It seems that his reputation for solid scholarship, his integrity, his humility would not allow his bishop, nor the majority of his colleagues, to label him as deranged or heretical, as he had thought they would. George was really in a dilemma to find a way out of the church. He could not resign because his wife utterly opposed such a step, and he could not get himself dismissed, even by the most forthright declaration of belief and fellowship in another religious system. But he did not give up. His two goals were to win his wife to complete allegiance to the Baha'i faith gaining her approval for leaving the church, and to proclaim even more strenuously that the fulfillment of Christianity was to accept Christ's return in the revelation of Baha'u'llah. He sent hundreds of copies of his two books to clergymen and laymen in Ireland and received some favorable reviews in newspapers. A fantastic proclamation opportunity occurred when he preached the sermon on June 30, 1940, in the National Cathedral, St. Patrick's in Dublin. He wrote later, "I spoke of harmony and concord as the purpose of Christianity and all true religion. Said the religion of Baha'u'llah was today the only religion I could find living up to this, and pleaded that we should follow suit, and closed by affirming that the future belongs to the church that did follow suit. The dean of the cathedral did what he never did to me before. He volunteered how much he liked the sermon and what a change it was from what they had been listening to of late." How sad to realize that in spite of their favorable attitude towards George's proclamation, not one other clergyman at that time felt moved to enter himself and his congregation into the New Jerusalem. Let us go back to 2 years earlier. In 1938, something totally amazing and undreamed of happened. George received a letter from his former fiancée, Nellie Roche of Tennessee. It was in 1916 that they had last met. George went to Ireland for the summer of 1916, intending to return to the university in Sewanee, Tennessee. But illness, and possibly the heartache of the broken engagement, decided him to stay in Ireland and start over. Nellie had become a Baha'i in 1937. George's writings appeared in Baha'i publications, which Nellie saw, and of course recognized his name as her long-ago love. George's reply brought her up to date on all that had transpired in the last 22 years, especially his hopes of finding a way to support his family outside of his position in the church. Nellie's response to this was to offer him her newly received inheritance of $5,000 as a loan until he could receive steady income. This filled him with hope and happiness. George was the lone Baha'i in the whole of Ireland for many years, until his son and daughter were old enough to understand and join him in activity. He would have infrequent visits from traveling Baha'is, and sometimes he would travel to London to meet with Baha'is. The correspondence with Nellie gave him great spiritual comradeship and encouragement in his isolation. With the safety net of her loan, he resolved to resign as soon as the war was over, moved to Dublin and work as a freelance writer. Nancy wavered between cooperating with this and bouts of anxiety. She wrote to Nellie asking her to appeal to George to wait until he reached retirement age in order to receive his pension. Nellie's response was so wise and understanding that Nancy was inspired to host weekly firesides where George taught the faith to their friends and neighbors. He wrote that the Baha'i meetings, started in November 1942, were an astonishing success. Shortages caused by the war increased. Kind and generous Nellie sent food parcels to the Townsend family. Nellie passed away in 1958, surviving George by 16 months. In 1946, George was filled with happiness and pride because their daughter Una, then 25 years old, became the first pioneer to Dublin. George sent the Guardian's history of the first 100 years of the Baha'i faith, entitled God Passes By, with letters proclaiming the return of Christ to senior clergy in Ireland, no doubt hoping that one of them would take offense and force him out of the church. Finally, someone objected to him. In spring 1947, George's bishop showed him a letter from an Anglican missionary complaining that George's book, The Promise of All Ages, exalted Baha'u'llah at the expense of Christ. George responded to the bishop's questioning by plainly declaring his belief in Baha'u'llah as the return of Christ. He wrote the Guardian that the bishop was kind, but very narrow and utterly perplexed, and departure from the church appeared to be at hand. On the advice of the National Spiritual Assembly of the British Isles, George decided to resign from the church in September 1947 and moved to Dublin to help establish the first local Baha'i assembly in Ireland. The National Assembly pledged to assist him financially and to support Nancy if she would become widowed. All 9 national Baha'i assemblies in the world at that time felt honored to contribute support. By leaving the church, George forfeited all insurance and pension he had paid into. He was 71 years old and had no real assets other than some royalties from his books. A small house was found in a suburb of Dublin and purchased with the help of Nellie's loan, and they moved in October 1947. George's resignation was received kindly by his bishop, who praised him for his character and his many years of faithful and efficient work. To explain his unprecedented act and to promote the cause of Baha'u'llah as the revitalizing, unifying force for all the sects of Christianity, George wrote a clear and beautiful essay called The Old Churches and the New World Faith, which can be found in his biography and in Volume 13 of the Baha'i World. It is interesting to note the extent of the distribution of copies. In the British Isles, 8,122. Australia, 5,000. United States, 2,000. Canada, 4,000, plus an unknown number to Egypt and Germany. These were sent to the clergy, politicians, professionals, and leaders, even to the King of the British Empire, who returned an acknowledgment. All 9 national spiritual assemblies contributed to the effort. Plans and personnel set up to deal with the expected response proved unnecessary. The response was slight, mostly formal acknowledgments. It must have been a tremendous disappointment to all who worked so hard on the project. The Guardian wrote, "Your challenging letter to the Christians, so well conceived, has shown clearly how deep is the sleep of the heedless these days. It is like knocking on a grave. The dead make no response." The sudden change from the spacious country house, the rectory at Hesgraw, with a maid and gardener, to the small home, tiny yard, and no household help, was too difficult a change for Nancy. She missed her many friends, knowing no one in Dublin at first. Nevertheless, she actually enrolled in the faith and became a member of the first spiritual assembly in Dublin. George was delighted with his wife finally by his side spiritually. They went on teaching trips and attended summer schools. But it was a short-lived event, as Nancy never adjusted well to living in Dublin and became withdrawn, refusing to participate in the Baha'i hospitality and activities which George wanted to do. When Adib Taherzadeh, who later became a well-known Baha'i author and member of the Universal House of Justice, moved to Dublin, George was overjoyed, as Adib provided the spiritual companionship and stimulation he needed. George was chairman of the local assembly and delegate to the national convention, active in all kinds of teaching and study meetings, yet November 1951 found him descending into depression. He wrote to the Guardian, deploring his waning enthusiasm, feeling that he had somehow failed to do what the Guardian and Abdu'l-Bahá expected of him. A month passed before he had a reply, which to his utter astonishment was a personal cable from the Guardian, informing him that he was elevated to the rank of a hand of the cause of God, the first in Europe. George became imbued with a renewed spirit and rose to his new responsibilities with all the fervor of his great loving heart. In 1953, 4 intercontinental teaching conferences were held. George, accompanied by Nancy, attended the one in Stockholm, Sweden, as a representative of the Guardian. He addressed the conference on the sufferings of Baha'u'llah and their significance, a masterpiece which is reproduced in the Baha'i World, Volume 12 and 16. As a hand of the cause, he fostered the spiritual welfare of the Baha'is in the British Isles, Norway, Faroe Islands, and Iceland. A new force of love and enthusiasm poured forth from him. His great knowledge of the Baha'i faith and Christian scriptures confirmed souls beyond number. In his last days, ill and weak from Parkinson's disease, instead of resting, George gave his utmost exertion to finish a book he had started many years before, called Christ and Baha'u'llah. Unable to speak or write, he whispered the final pages to his son and daughter. It expounds the vision of history as spiritual evolution and was written explicitly for Christians, clearly explaining how Baha'u'llah is Christ returned in the glory of the Father. The Guardian called it George's crowning achievement and urged its use in vigorous teaching and publicity programs in English-speaking countries. David Hoffman, his publisher and biographer, calls the book an epic, a masterpiece, indeed a work of genius. Fortunately, it is still in print, and I feel essential reading for any thoughtful Christian who is struggling to understand the relationship between Christ and Baha'u'llah. George passed away on March 25, 1957, a few days after his crowning achievement came into print. Tributes poured in, many from those whom he had served as a clergyman in Ahaskra. Una wrote, "A Roman Catholic told us how she and many others went to him for advice. They knew he would never breathe a word to anyone. She spoke of his absolute goodness and said the local people all said he was a saint. George was also deeply mystical and expressed it in thrilling poetry. His poems and prayers of spiritual longing collected in a book called The Mission of Baha'u'llah bring tears to the eyes, but joy to the soul. The tribute from the Guardian called George, "Dearly loved, greatly gifted, most distinguished collaborator. His sterling qualities, his scholarship, his challenging writings, his high ecclesiastical position unrivaled any Baha'i Western world, entitle him rank with Thomas Brakewell, Dr. Esselmont, one of three luminaries shedding brilliant luster annals, Irish, English, Scottish, Baha'i communities. His fearless championship cause he loved so dearly, served so valiantly, constitutes significant landmark British Baha'i history." Fulfilled an important mission in the establishment of the Baha'i administrative order in the Western world under the direction of the Guardian. For those who have become Baha'is in recent years, it is possible that they are not familiar with the self-sacrifice and accomplishments of this great American believer who was elevated to the rank of Hand of the Cause in 1951. While the term administrative order might sound less than exciting, let us consider that without proper administration, any great endeavor will break down and dissipate for numerous reasons, such as lack of communication, confusion in line of command, factionalism, and the like. We know that the Baha'i administrative order is not of man-made design, but is firmly based on the revealed word of Baha'u'llah and the authorized interpretations of Abdu'l-Bahá and after him, Shoghi Effendi. It is the vehicle by which the world-unifying teachings of Baha'u'llah will attain the supremely noble goal, that of unifying the disparate peoples of the world and applying justice. Horace Holly became the Guardian's right-hand man in America. So completely reliable, efficient, and capable was he in implementing the Guardian's directives on the establishment of the administrative order. Horace Hotchkiss Holly was born in 1887 in Connecticut, and his ancestors included many educators and ministers. His major in college was literature. He had a brilliant analytical mind and also had another side, that of an idealist and mystic. He was a published poet. After college, he went to Europe in 1909. He met a young lady who showed him a book that changed the course of his life. The book was Abbas Effendi, His Life and Teachings. Mr. Holly wrote that at first he thought it, quote, possible to encompass the revelation of Baha'u'llah by reducing it to a formula. Gradually my ventures proved that I myself was to be encompassed, reoriented, remolded in all the realms of my being." End quote. Mr. Holly married and was living in Italy in 1911 when they heard that Abdu'l-Bahá was in France. They immediately traveled to attain the presence of the Master. Horace underwent a kind of instantaneous spiritual rebirth upon his first glimpse of Abdu'l-Bahá at a distance. My whole body underwent a shock. My heart leapt. My knees weakened. A thrill of acute receptive feeling flowed from head to foot. While my own personality was flowing away, a new being, not my own, assumed its place. A glory poured into me, and I was conscious of a most intense impulse to admire. From Italy, Mr. Holly, his wife and little daughter, moved to Paris, where he operated an art gallery. In 1913, he wrote his first book about the Baha'i faith, entitled Baha'ism, the Modern Social Religion. It was praised by Abdu'l-Bahá. Another move, this time to New York City in 1914, where he worked for a publishing company and then an advertising agency. The first National Spiritual Assembly of the United States and Canada was formed in 1922. The next year, Horace was elected a member and was re-elected for a total of 36 years. He served as the secretary for 34 years. That must be a record. In 1925, Mr. Holly gave up his personal career to devote his entire time to Baha'i work. Imagine the sacrifice, to give up a high salary and a big city career to work for a religion little known and unappreciated by the world at large, with only very modest compensation from the Baha'i Fund. Don't forget that during those years the pressing need and overwhelming financial responsibility for the Baha'is was supporting the construction of the Mother Temple of the West and the superstructure of the Shrine of the Bab. However, Mr. Holly must have found working for the faith much more satisfying than anything else. Shoghi Effendi was extremely appreciative of his efficient service and really wanted and needed Mr. Holly to help him in Haifa, but sacrificed this wish as he realized Horace was indispensable to the fledgling Baha'i administration in America. The Guardian wrote him, "My dearest co-worker, your personal contribution to so many aspects and phases of the movement, performed so diligently, so effectively, and so thoroughly, are truly a source of joy and inspiration to me. How much I feel the need of a similar worker by my side in Haifa, as competent, as thorough, as methodical, as alert as yourself. You cannot and should not leave your post for the present. Haifa will have to take care of itself for some time. Your grateful brother, Shoghi." Mr. Holly's literary talents were given freely in service to the faith. He wrote two more books, plus a book-length collection of his talks and essays. In 1921, he edited the first comprehensive compilation of the words of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá in English. It was later revised and published as Baha'i World Faith. He wrote for the early Baha'i magazine, Star of the West, was on the editorial board, and wrote for the publication World Order, and he was on the Baha'i Publishing Committee. Mr. Holly conceived the idea of a series of books recording the international activities of the faith. The Guardian enthusiastically accepted this idea, and thus the volumes called The Baha'i World came into being. Shoghi Effendi, acted as the editor-in-chief, and Mr. Hawley, the executor. Mr. Hawley wrote the section, International Survey of Current Baha'i Activities, for every volume up to the time of his passing in 1960. It was he who gave titles to the long general letters from the Guardian, picking out key phrases that captured the imagination of the readers and put subtitles throughout to facilitate their study. Mr. Hawley created and the Guardian approved publication of a regular newsletter for the Baha'is nationwide. Thus began in 1925 the magazine Baha'i News for 65 years, now evolved into the paper called The American Baha'i. With the help of a Baha'i lawyer, he wrote the Declaration of Trust of the National Assembly and the bylaws of a local assembly, which the Guardian made the pattern for similar legal instruments of the faith in all other countries. The National Secretariat was in New York City, naturally, as that was where the National Secretary lived. However, in 1939, the time came when Shoghi Effendi wished the Secretariat to move to the vicinity of the temple in Wilmette, Illinois. So the spiritual and administrative centers in America would be fused into one. Another major sacrifice for Mr. Hawley, to give up all that was familiar and enjoyable in New York and relocate to a small town in the Midwest. This trusted, deeply devoted servant, of course, realized the needs of the faith were of greater importance than his own. In Wilmette, he quickly made new friends, was accepted into Rotarians, and founded the Wilmette Historical Commission. In addition to his outstanding writing and publishing abilities, he was a distinguished speaker, giving public lectures and courses at Baha'i summer schools. December 1951, Shoghi Effendi announced the appointment of Horace Hawley as a hand of the cause in America, along with two others, Dorothy Baker and Leroy Ioas. But this rank and honor did not take him from continuing his work as Secretary of the National Spiritual Assembly. Did Mr. Hawley ever get to meet the Guardian he loved so much? Yes, in 1953, after attending intercontinental conferences in Chicago, Europe, Africa, and India at the request of the Guardian. After the passing of Shoghi Effendi in 1957, Mr. Hawley's fellow hands desired him to come and serve as one of the nine hands in the Holy Land. Therefore, he resigned from the National Assembly in 1959 and arrived in Haifa on the last day of that year. Another sacrificial move, as he was then 72 years old, in ill health and very frail. 6 months later, he passed away. The cablegram, a loving tribute from his fellow hands, read, "Grieved announced passing in Haifa of much loved, distinguished hand of the cause Horace Hawley, outstanding champion of the faith since days of the Master, praised by the beloved Guardian for unique contribution in development of the administrative order. His indefatigable services in protection, teaching, and administrative fields, and culminating service in the Holy Land is an inspiring example for present and future generations of Baha'is." Now, almost 40 years later, Are we not that future generation which is inspired by the example of true devotion, reliability, and detachment from self, which Hand of the Cause, Horace Holly, left as a priceless legacy? Dedicated servants of Baha'u'llah were related to you, it is timely to contemplate some of the outstanding qualities which made them so unique. Thornton Chase, May Maxwell, and George Townsend were, for a time, the only Baha'is in their respective countries. Chase in the United States, May in Europe and later Canada, and Hand of the Cause, Mr. Townsend, in Ireland. What steadfastness this takes, to be so firm in conviction that no kind of isolation could discourage, to stand out as different from their unawakened friends and family was not frightening to them. The epitome of the words spoken by the Master to May at the close of her pilgrimage in 1899. And now, I give you a commandment which shall be for a covenant between you and me, that ye have faith, that your faith be steadfast as a rock, that no storms can move, that nothing can disturb, and that it endure through all things, even to the end. Be not shaken in your faith, for I am with you always, whether living or dead, I am with you to the end. As you have faith, so shall your powers and blessings be. This is the balance. This is the balance. This is the balance. It's obvious that all these souls had the supreme quality of steadfastness, like a rock that no storms could move. And those who lived to be elderly never became content that they had accomplished enough and settled back for restful inactivity. The early American believers exhibited firmness in their attachment to the center of the covenant when confronted with the spirit of rebellion in some contemporaries. John Bosch is an inspiring example of obedience to the law of Baha'u'llah by giving up his ties to liquor production. In this faith, sooner or later, we become aware of the bounties and blessings that descend into our lives as an unavoidable consequence of obedience to the sacred laws. All of them showed great love to all, that kind of love that is born from the words of Abdu'l-Bahá. Real love is impossible unless one turn his face towards God and be attracted to His beauty. And all had innate self-effacement and humility about their considerable accomplishments, feeling themselves to be only instruments for the purposes of the Beloved. Surely they acutely understood this prayer from Abdu'l-Bahá. O Son of Bounty, send down a shaft of light. Grant us pity, grant us grace. By thy beauty, we come with no provisions but our sins, with no good deeds to tell of, only hopes.